chat. Thank you. Welcome to this meeting of the Scrutiny Commission for Charnwood Borough Council. There are a number of things that I would like to remind people of before we start the items on the agenda. Please note that this meeting is being recorded and the recording will be made available on the Council's website following the meeting. Under the Openness of Local Government Bodies regulation, people may film or record this meeting, and this is outside the Council's control. However, people wishing to film or record the meeting should do so in a way that it doesn't disrupt the business of the meeting. Also, so that the meeting is not disturbed, could I ask everyone present to please turn off your mobile phones or switch them to silent and ensure that your environment is distraction free. Thank you. This meeting of the Scrutiny Commission is being held as a hybrid meeting, with some meeting participants joining the meeting virtually. I will now ask those members if they can see or hear the meeting. We've had quite a few notifications that people are coming, but not necessarily whether it's virtual or actual. So what I'm seeing at the moment is, he's probably lurking somewhere, Councillor Hamilton, Deputy Leader of the Council and Lead Member for Public and Private Sector Housing.
He's not here yet.
Nope. Is the only ones that I hear that are ones I can see?
Yeah. Richard was there a minute ago, but he's disappeared.
Right, so I'm just going to skip to Sarah Hallam. Team leader for planning enforcement. Can you see and hear the proceedings?
Yes, Sarah. I can. Thank you very much, Chair. Okay.
Thank you. Richard Bennett. No, he hasn't. Okay. Justin Henry, Director of Commercial and Economic Development. Can you see and hear the proceedings?
Yes, thank you, Chair. I can see and hear.
Thank you very much. Councillor Hamilton, Deputy Leader of Council and Lead Member for Public and Private Sector Housing. Welcome, can you see and hear us?
I can both see and hear proceedings.
Thank you very much. I've also got down here Councillor Jigadega, Councillor Ashcroft down here is probably will be arriving later. Any apologies, please?
Yes, Chair, we've had apologies from Councillor Beverly Gray, Councillor Nat Taylor, Councillor Harper Davis, and we've got Councillor Monk as a substitute, and also Councillor Needham, and we've got Councillor Infield as a substitute.
Thank you both for coming today. Minutes from previous meetings. Are you content to receive the minutes? There are two lots of minutes, the formal meeting and the one that was held, I've forgotten the word, but
closed
anyway.
Session.
That's it, closed session. That you're doing very nicely, thank you. And right, so am I all right to sign those minutes and forward them on? Thank you very much. Right, item three, disclosures of pecuniary interest and others registrable and non-registrable interests. And I've had none known to me. And the same for item four, no declarations of party whip unless you know different. Item five, there's no questions under scrutiny committee procedures. Item six is selective licensing update, and for that I'll welcome lead member Councillor Hamilton.
My apologies.
Thank you, Jim. Very quickly to introduce.
Sorry, Councillor, could you just hold on just a second?
All right, I see.
Thank you.
Okay. Have we got Katie Moore?
Yeah.
But looking right over you, Katie. Sorry, Councillor Hamilton, can you just hold on a minute, please? Because I want to welcome Katie Moore, because this is the first time you've been to this meeting, and I've never met you before. So, welcome to the meeting. Right, first of all, I'll ask you to explain and introduce this, please, Councillor Hamilton. Thank you.
Yes. Hopefully I'm just doing a very quick introduction, which is basically to say this is simply an update to the Scrutiny Commission about the delivery of the private sector housing selective licensing scheme. What that very, very briefly is about is, you know, there's a requirement for licensing set for HMOs, but you have selective licensing for small HMOs and also for private rented sector. In this case, it's within a part of Loughborough. It was originally two wards, Loughborough, Hastings, Leamington, which is now part of Loughborough East, which is that part of Loughborough that lies to the east of Leicester Road, Derby Road, towards the railway station. And the purpose of this is simply to give you the information of how things are going and to see if there's any further actions that you want to be taken. The reason being is, for the effective scrutiny of, for the delivery of the selecting licensing scheme. So I can pass to Katie now.
Thank you. Thank you then, Katie. And I think it would be helpful if you explained what the selective licensing was, is supposed to achieve.
Okay.
Thank you. That would
Thank
be good.
You.
Cheers.
Thank you. So, as Councillor Hamilton said, there is a statutory duty to deliver a mandatory licensing scheme for some mostly larger HMOs, but there is discretionary power to introduce an additional licensing scheme for all HMOs and then a selective licensing scheme, which can be some parts of the borough or all of the borough, depending on kind of need and evidence that it's warranted. So we've introduced the additional and the selective schemes. They officially launched on the 1st of April, although we did start taking applications slightly before that so we could kind of help landlords to get those applications submitted and get prepared for them. So the purpose really of mandatory and discretionary licensing schemes is to make sure that private sector properties in the area are maintained to a good standard, so the actual condition of the property itself and also the management practices of the landlords. So there are terms and conditions around licences that landlords have to agree to and have to follow to be able to maintain a licence. So landlords need to apply for a licence, and then after a certain period of time they would need to apply for renewal to be able to retain it. So we have had a positive response to the licensing schemes. We've received over 1,700 applications in total for the three types of schemes, and not over 900 of those were for the selective licensing schemes in the two parts of Charnwood. There is a fee for the licences as well, so there's a kind of a part fee that landlords pay when they first apply, and the purpose of that fee is for us to make sure that we're checking we've got all the evidence we need. We're doing checks to make sure the landlords are kind of reputable, if you see what I mean, and a reasonable person to act as a landlord, and to actually check all of the proofs that have come in, assist the landlords to do their applications, check the applications, and then actually make a decision about the licence, grant the licence, and issue those to landlords. So we have received quite a large amount of applications, obviously over 1,700, which is significantly more than we received under the previous mandatory scheme. So we've got two licensing administration officers whose role it is to administer the licenses, and then we have another number of other officers within the team who can carry out other checks to make, you know, visits to properties, inspections, make sure landlords are adhering to the licenses. So we've realised that with the quantity of applications we've got in quite a short space of time, we do need to increase the resource within the service to make sure we're able to deliver the scheme. So we have just increased from two licensing admin officers to six licensing admin officers between now and the end of the year to try and make sure we get through those license applications and make decisions about those as quickly as we possibly can, to give the landlords some assurance about what's happening with their application. The fees that you receive from the licensing applications fully cover the cost of those staff, so there's no additional cost to the authority for the processing of the applications. I mean, that is what the fee is for. It is for the actual processing of the applications. Once the licences are granted and decisions are made, the second part of the fee is due, and that is really for making sure that landlords are maintaining, they are adhering to the terms of the agreement, and that everything is running as it should be within those properties.
Thank you. Any questions? Yes.
What? You covered nearly everything I was going to ask, which is great. Yeah. It's just a follow-on from kind of the last point you made, that we're switching from two licensing officers to six licensing officers, obviously to cope with the demand. So we look at the numbers and we haven't really determined that many compared to how many we've received in Yes. You know, that's since February, so it's quite a chunk of time now.
Yeah.
And I can understand that we're increasing the resource to pick up that backlog.
Yeah.
Do we feel that 6 is going to be sufficient now to fulfil that, kind of to catch up and then to maintain this going forward? Because my understanding is that it was to be cost neutral, so we're not allowed to gain from the scheme, but that it wasn't going to cost us as a borough anything extra to run the scheme.
Yes. So we've done a calculation. A lot of the groundwork has been done already, with a lot of the applications that have already been received. A lot of guidance has been given to landlords. A lot of the proofs have already been checked. So it's just a matter of actually making those decisions. So just to give an example, in the last 2 weeks, we've made decisions on 148 of the applications, and that's with the current 2 officers that we've got in post, with a bit of support from kind of the other standards officers and the manager within the service. So we did calculate sort of around 12 to 13 decisions per officer would need to be made for those 6 officers between now and the end of March to be able to clear the backlog, also taking into account that we expect probably around 500 extra applications to be received in that time period. So if our calculations are right, and if we can recruit to those posts and maintain kind of the staff for that whole period, we should be able to deal with those. And we think after April next year, we'll do a review at some point before then to have a look at kind of the normal sort of ongoing level of applications, because we don't expect to receive 1,700 every year. We've expected the majority. There will probably be some landlords that either didn't know about the scheme or didn't apply in time that we will need to kind of take that up with, identify them and then address that. So we will probably receive some next year, but not nearly as many. With the mandatory scheme, we get renewal applications every year because that's been running for a few years, so we'll expect that to kind of carry on. Prior to the introduction of the additional and selective schemes, we didn't have any licensing specific officers. That workload was absorbed by the existing team, but we think, because as you can kind of see, the bulk of the applications
has been... Yeah, the mandatory is such a small number in comparison to the total now, isn't it?
Yeah, so we need to do a review basically nearer to the time to look at how many licences were granted, how many we think may come in over future years, and then review, because we don't think we'll need 6 admin officers, unless the scheme expands further. We don't think we'll need 6 to be able to do that.
Thank you.
Yes, you mentioned
what
the licensing fee covers. But I have noticed looking around that licensing fees vary considerably across different local authorities. Does that mean some of them are just a little bit more generous in estimating the costs, or are we being a bit close to the edge on that? And so that was my question, really.
So when we decided the fee for the new schemes, we based that on the fee that we charged the mandatory schemes, which has been... been kind of the same for a period of time. I think we've estimated that based on how much it costs us to do the administration for the actually making the decision. The first part of the fee is specifically for that side of it, so it's you can't kind of use that for the later stages around investigation and things like that. So we've assessed that as being a reasonable fee. We are aware that there are some other authorities that give discounts to landlords if they've got multiple properties, or if they've got multiple properties within the same block. So that is something that we are considering, so we may do something along those lines, and it's potential that the fees could increase potentially in future years by a small percentage, depending on if our costs increase relating to that.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you. My question would be, obviously for the selective licensing scheme, there's 23 licences granted, subject to a calling off period, and none have been refused. So those 23 for selective licences, have they been visited? Have the houses been inspected?
Not as yet, no. No, it's not a requirement prior to granting a licence to do the inspection.
Right.
It's something that we are looking to do. So we've, in addition to the administration officers, we've also appointed 2 additional standards officers, and their role is going to be more focused on checking compliance and doing those inspections and visits.
So, sorry, those 23, it says licensing subject, granted.
Yeah.
But their homes have not been inspected. So so they've not been given a license yet.
So there's a calling off period for all the licences, which essentially means when we make a decision about whether or not to grant a licence, we issue a draft licence, and there's a calling off period of, I believe it's 3 weeks, when there's a potential for kind of queries to be raised around that. after that cooling off period, then the final license is granted.
But nobody will go and visit the home.
We will visit as part of it will be spot checking visits. We've not got the resource to visit every single property that's got a license.
So I could still be a landlord, yes, that doesn't care a dot about the person who's in my property, as long as I've filled the sheet in well and dotted all the I's and crossed all the T's, then I shall be given a draft license and hope that you don't decide to call on me in the next 5 years.
So there is a requirement for landlords to provide evidence, so that will include things like gas and electric safety checks and documentation.
Well, they're legally required anyway, aren't they?
Yes, yeah. Yeah, and we do checks, so we can check on registers for landlords, where there have been previous concerns raised. We've got our own records as well of issues where we've had concerns raised by other tenants or neighbours around properties and how they're being managed.
So another hypothesis here, I'm a landlord that that intimidates my tenant, and my tenant won't complain about anything. You know, and they will just get lost. And I think the difference between selective licensing in different areas is the fact that in the city, they go out and inspect the houses.
Yeah. I think it's fair to say that our existing housing standard service prior was more reactive, that it would be based on reports of issues. With the licensing schemes, the idea, the reason why we've recruited additional resources is so that we can be more proactive, so we can try to identify landlords that aren't adhering, kind of either aren't applying, aren't registering, or aren't adhering to the licenses, so there will be visits that will be carried out.
Yeah, Councillor Monk.
Thank you. I'm presuming then landlords can still rent their properties out while they're applying for the licence, so we're not holding up people renting properties, are we?
No.
But then what happens if they refuse the licence? They then can't rent that property and they've already got people in. Do you see what I mean? What happens then?
So I will find out.
Sorry, we're not here to put you on the spot.
It's a trick question. I don't want to be holding up 930 people, you know, waiting to rent the 930 properties empty, and you've got a backlog of applications.
Yeah.
Do you see what I mean? And then if you refuse that, you know, then what happens? Do you keep your tenants out? What do they do? What do the landlords do?
I know that a lot of the work that's being done at the moment is about advising landlords on what they need to do to make sure that they do meet those standards. So there is a lot of that goes on. Mm. I think the vast majority of landlords that have applied are the ones that want, they either know already, you know, they're good landlords, they want to be good landlords, so they either know already what their requirements are, or they're willing
to do that.
I think the ones that we need to find are the ones that probably don't.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
That is my concern, that you're going for low-lying fruit at the moment, and they're the ones that will register and play the game properly and care for their tenants. But the whole idea of the scheme, that may be corrected here, was to sort out the landlords, the absent landlords, or the landlords that did not provide the fire blankets or the monoxide or do the checks on water and heating, gas and electricity, or the mould, etc. And so on. And are these requirements of the landlord, are they to the same standards as required for council housing?
Yes, they are. They're quite a high standard. It's something that we're actually, we've been having discussions around. The terms and conditions are quite strict for the licensing schemes. And in comparison to other areas, there's a lot more terms and conditions in there than some areas. So we are confident that they are of a high standard. We are looking at possibly reviewing them to make them clearer, because there's some duplication around some of the terms, so we are in the process of reviewing them, but you know, we are satisfied that those terms and conditions are of a good standard. You see what I mean?
Okay. Councillor Lanning.
Is there any scope in communicating on the website what the standards are and reminding tenants
and landlords what they are.
Yes.
And that there is a system of licensing in Charnwood. So publicise it wider, because some people just don't know, tenants particularly, younger people.
Yeah, there is some information on the website already, but I think that is mostly aimed at landlords. Mm. So yeah, we'll have a look, ask for that to be reviewed, and we'll make sure that it is.
Because I know, clear. I mean, from a personal experience, when my kids were at university, there's some rough stuff about. But also, when one of them was working and went into an HMO temporarily, there was quite a bit to be desired from the property that she was renting at a scandalous amount.
And don't forget, this isn't just aimed at HMOs. They're ranged at other private tenants.
Oh yeah,
but the couples or a family.
It tends to be HMOs where.
There's
not declared, and it is wider than Loughborough as well, because we've got students that live in Shepshire.
Definitely, yes. As I say, the private tenants are all over Charnwood, private landlords. So my question would be, you've got 1,755 that have applied, mm-hmm. and 954 are from selective licensing. How many have not applied? Do we know that figure? Have we had a guesstimate at the figure that's not applied?
So we don't know the figure. That's one of the tasks that is going to be for the new standards officers, is to make sure that we are doing everything we can to try and identify any non-licensed properties where people haven't applied. I believe there was some estimate figures that were provided previously. I don't have them to hand, but I can.
I'm correcting myself here. I've said all over Charnwood. Of course, it's not. It's in two areas in Loughborough. Sorry about that. And I would like to go one further, if we could possibly think of this or recommend it. Each year we send a publication out to our tenants, our residents, and so it can be focused in a certain area of the council tax. And I wondered whether the certain areas could also have these standards sent to them on that mailing.
Yeah, it makes sense. We've tended to do it on like waste collections and bins and stuff previously, but
it's because it can be targeted to that particular postcoded area, can't it? So that is a sure way of getting it to the right. To the right people. Mm-hmm. I know not everybody in that area will have a private landlord. There'll be a lot that have purchased the property and that, but a lot will be private landlords. So that would be a targeted posting for them, wouldn't it? Sorry, Councillor Fox, you wanted
to? No, sorry. You've just said what I was going to say.
Yeah.
How do you determine?
Sorry, Councillor Infield.
Yes, just to follow up, but when we do identify houses that should have licences and don't, what enforcement actions can we take, and have we been taking those actions in the past?
So with the mandatory scheme, there would have been a requirement for it to be in place for the larger HMOs for quite a long period of time. I can find out about enforcement action that's been taken previously in cases where we haven't identified. I know that something that we do have as a standard approach in the service is that we try to offer support first, so we do try to assist landlords to understand the requirements and to meet those requirements initially before we go down the enforcement route. And I believe in most cases that is how we resolve it and how we improve the situation. But I can find out in previous enforcement action on the mandatory scheme. I don't believe we've taken any yet with additional or selective, because we are still working with those landlords to get the applications in and processed and make those decisions. But for the mandatory scheme, I can find out.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks. And the standards, could they be sent to each councillor, please?
Yes, the terms and
the standards that actually
they need to be met.
It wouldn't be, because we're not necessarily the councillor for that area, are we? But I'd still like to know what the standards are that have to be met.
I remember specifically
It came through Cabinet previously, so
yeah,
I think I saw it a number of times. But I think it's useful for people to know. Yeah.
I've just looked at what happens if somebody doesn't apply for a selective licence. Who should? A person commits an offence by being in control of a property which requires a licence but is not so licensed. The offence may lead to a civil penalty charge of up to £30,000, or alternatively a criminal conviction and an unlimited fine.
Serious.
Okay. Right.
But it would take me
help stages.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Go through the process first. Yes.
Nobody wants to do that straight off the bat. So, would it be helpful then if we all knew the standards that are required? Yeah, I think so. If we could do that, please. Mm-hmm. Any other questions? No. Councillor Hamilton, would you like to comment on anything that's been spoken about, please?
No, I just found this has been a very useful conversation, and it's good that there's been a number of actions have arisen to help kind of clarify what is really a new scheme that's still settling in. So I think it's been very valuable, this discussion.
Okay, so I would like this to come back to this committee.
That's what I was just going
to say. Probably in April next year when it's been running
a year,
if that's okay. And is that all right with the rest of the committee?
Yeah.
Yeah. So thank you very much for coming, Councillor Hamilton and Katie. And please take Galaxy Bar with you.
Thank you.
Thank you. You just took a breath then. I thought, what have I done wrong? We're on to item 7 now, which is pre-decision scrutiny for any specific financial matters to be considered by the Cabinet. There are none. So, item 8, Cabinet items for pre-decision scrutiny. The following items have been identified. The first one is item 8A, Climate Change Strategy and Action Plan, page 20 of your agenda. The lead member is...
Sent apologies.
Yeah. So we have got the lovely Justin to take us through. Thank you.
Certainly, thank you, Chair. Excuse me, but unfortunately Maria French, who planned to attend, hasn't been able to make it tonight due to illness. So if there are any matters arising in terms of questions, I would ask the committee if it's okay if we refer those back to Maria for a written response if required. But the paper that you're scrutinizing here is effectively to introduce an updated climate change strategy, the original going through Cabinet in 2018. This strategy also incorporates the outcome of the carbon neutral plan, which was adopted in, I believe it was September 21, and brings the two together. They were previously managed in two separate streams. And of course, this has also undergone a significant level of consultation with the public before its creation, which we did online and through various focus groups, including focus groups at the college. So I am happy to go ahead and take any questions.
Thank you, Justin. I actually found this quite heavy going to read, and I kept having to reread different sections as well. And that's not probably because it wasn't well written. It's just that I wanted to get a better understanding of it. So, but it's well presented.
It's very thorough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right, are there any questions on this? Councillor Rattray.
Just 2 points really, well, 3 in the fact that, one, it's very thorough and it was great to see this kind of coming forward, and I think there's lots of actions that are being taken that will really step us forward, so I was just really pleased to see it and to see all of the information that's in the report. The 2 specific points to the report. Where one is it's on page 50 in relation to private cars, and let me find the specific point where it says it. But my concern is, whilst I appreciate that we want to
direct people to more sustainable means of travel. I would not want us to go so far that we would alienate private cars, especially those that are moving towards a more green basis. So where someone is driving an electric car, let's not demonise them for it being a private car. So that's my point kind of on that one. I think we need to be a little careful that we're not, there's the point there. So support a shift for travel by private car to walking, cycling and public transport. For me, I just wanted two little words at the end of that to say where possible. Because there are certain situations where the only means of getting around is by private car, whether that's someone's got a long commute or there's lots of different reasons. So I'm fully supportive of looking for the most sustainable version where possible, but let's not demonise private car drivers where that is their means of getting around and there isn't an alternative option. And then the second point was not so much to do with something that's in the report, but maybe something to do with that's not in the report, which was to do with planning and housing. And for me, I'd like to see us go further on sustainability within planning and housing. And I would give the Broadnook development as an example. So where we are building such a large scheme of new build properties, so it's nearly 2,000 properties for Broadnook, it's essentially a village of its own, that we should be looking to make that a sustainable town village. Whether that's, it should all have solar panels on every property within that development, or that we should actually be looking, you know, Broadnook as a development is a huge scheme, there is lots and lots of open space within that development, and actually could that development or a future development of the same scale, more relevantly, should that have wind power on that scheme? And that for me, I feel like we need to be just slightly more ambitious on the planning and housing side. And I understand that Richard's probably going to come back to me and say that it's more to do with kind of how the government leads that strategy on that side of it. But for me, I would like to see us being a little bit more ambitious with planning and housing and how we make that sustainable.
Richard. I'd like you to come in here, Richard. And I've sat with CEG now for, 15, 16 years. And the last 5 years, 6 years, prior to any building, we've changed our tact on talking to them and said, can't we have fitted electric points for the cars? Because to retrofit it is costly. And it spoils the look of the place as well, because it's all going to be hunky-dory and marvellous, our Thorpebury, which is 4,500. But we've been told no, because of the government is dragging their heels on this and not forcing the developers into any of the situations where they have to provide panels, solar panels or electric points. Richard.
Good evening, members. Nice to see you all. And gold star to Councillor Seaton for your response there to Councillor Rattray. You're right. We need to be mindful, actually, that the sustainable urban extensions, the clues in the word sustainable, they were actually planned, much earlier. A lot of the formative work on planning for these SUEs was, back in sort of 2014-2015, in accordance with the council's policy set and also government guidance at that time. So it is a bit behind the curve with regard to the latest standards for energy efficiency and all that good stuff. So we need to be mindful of that, but. As we go forward in time, and new developments that come forward in our local plan, they are in our draft local plan that's coming forward. The developments that we've planned for are of much smaller scale than the SUEs. We're talking about sites of sort of 100, 200 homes, or there's one or two that are bigger than that, but not to the same scale as Thorpebury or Broadnook or Garendon Park. So the opportunities for sort of district-wide, well, not district-wide, but development-wide sort of energy generation what do they call it, district heating, but on a scale of 3,000 homes, is much less. However, what I would say is in the draft local plan that's coming forward, we do have quite a suite of policies there which set out our ambition around reducing our impact on the climate, energy efficiency and sustainable construction, as well as sustainable transport as well. So we are heading in the right direction. The issue is really what you said, Councillor Seaton, it's what we can actually say in planning policy documents to force developers to build places in a manner that we would like to see, complete with things like energy charging points and car charging points rather, and solar panels on roofs and all this kind of stuff. In a planning context, the government is encouraging us to do stuff. And it leaves the regulation to the building regulations. So a lot of the stuff around, restricting water usage and energy efficiency and charging points and that sort of stuff is coming forward through the building regulations rather than through planning. So what we can really do is to encourage through planning and leave it to building control to secure the stuff. Hopefully that's helpful.
I know we've got a small development in Beebe that is off-grid. I believe it's got a field behind it, but when I say it's a small development, it is 5 houses. So that's requiring a field behind it. So God knows how much land, 4,500 houses, or in your case, 2,000 houses would need for that. And I'd like to see a little bit more emphasis from Charnwood towards the sustainability and a bit more adventurous, and we've got the landscaping and we all put in native trees and this, that, the other, but it's almost blah blah, just put them in now, because that's I can remember being on planning probably 15 years ago, and we used to get quite excited about make sure that the native trees, now that just happens. So these things will happen, but unfortunately the Broadnooks and the Thorpe Burries will already be done, and the roads will be dug up while they put in different things and different heating supplies for each individual houses, where we've missed really missed the boat of having it fitted at the time of the house being built. And I wondered whether developers, when you're buying one of the houses, and I can only talk to Thorpebury because I've gone into the show homes, there's nowhere to say, like, I'll have plot 620, but I would like solar panels and I would like electric points. There's no availability for that at the moment, and that would be good for them to sort of say, that's what I want.
Yeah, they can add an option
now. Okay, but it will cost you so many £1,000 more. But some of those houses will be expensive houses, and a couple of thousand more might not make all. I'd like that option to be there, and I'm not quite sure how we could persuade developers to put that option on the table when it is initially being built. So, yes, sorry, Councillor Enfield.
So, in the draft plan, obviously there are some useful encouragements to developers, for example, to lay out houses even if they haven't got PV, so they could be later retrofitted with PV. But to date, I haven't seen, in the plans that are coming forward, I don't see any evidence yet of developers taking that on board. Obviously developers vary. Some developers are taking already an interest in ground source heat pumps, grouped supplies, small numbers of houses that could be applied on the smaller developments as well as the larger ones. And I'm just wondering whether we can somehow send signals to the developers that if they come with these sorts of more forward-looking plans, that they're going to find life an awful lot easier and they'll get the support of planning officers, whereas if they don't, then they ought to find the process just a little bit harder to encourage them to move into the future properly.
Councillor Bennett or
sorry,
Mr. Bennett or one wants that.
Thank you, Chair. There's quite a few issues involved in that question, really. Firstly, the council's sending out a strong signal in its draft local plan that it will have policies that seek to have these kind of sustainable construction techniques in place to make sure that the housing that we're developing now is fit for the longer term into the future. Whilst we can't insist through planning that certain things are put in place, we can try to ensure that properties can be retrofitted, but actually the stick's going to come through the building regulations. That's where it's going to come from. So developers will be mindful that the houses that they're building need to be compliant with the building regulations, and they will be providing the air source, heat pumps and solar panels and whatever it is that they need to do to make sure they've got the thermal efficiency of buildings in accordance with the appropriate regulations that are in place at that time. We do need to be mindful that developers they need to be able to source all of this equipment from suppliers to be able to build the houses that they need to build, and there is an adjustment going on in the broader economy at the moment in relation to gearing up to have the quantum of air source heat pumps and innovative energy efficiency materials to enable them to build houses to the appropriate specifications. This stuff doesn't just happen overnight. The industry needs to adapt and reboot and reposition itself in order to meet the regulations. We do need to be mindful of that. So it is happening. It's probably not happening as quickly as we would all like, to be fair, but it will happen in the fullness of time.
Okay. Just one more comment from me. I'm sorry, Justin, but this was your show, but Richard's stolen it. But we've got to be mindful of the solar panels as well. They have a life expectancy of 20 years, so they can't be recycled, can they? Apparently. So we've got all these solar panels that have to be replaced, and they can't be recycled. So instead of the butter mountain that we would have had in the 70s, we'll be having a solar panel mountain, because we can't separate the components out, apparently. Richard.
Thank you, Chair, for me. Just come back on that point. You make a very, very valid point there. We need to be mindful that the houses that we're building into the future are sustainable and they're not creating consequential effects by extension, by in error. And what we would say from a building control point of view is that these houses need to be built to a standard where actually they don't need any heating. They are passive houses. They don't need any heating, and if you build them in the right way, they actually need very minimal lighting, and so therefore the amount of energy take that they have is very minimal, actually, in real terms. That's the future I think we need to be aiming for, but I think we're not quite there yet, but that's the goal that we should be looking towards, I suggest.
But it's always good to have a goal and something to work to. Justin, would you like to close the debate on this? And as I say, the reason I had to go back and forth is because a lot of, obviously, is repeated between one and the other, and it's just joining up those dots in between, isn't it? But it's very well presented, and once I've got my head around the different chapters and differently, it's neatly... and it's not too busy, so it's something that I could digest. Councillor Lennie.
Can I bob in with a quick one about the flooding, planning land use and biodiversity?
Which page is that?
On page 910.
910.
And this tends to be a habit of developers doing sort of a couple of hundred houses at a time,
and not them not being linked as where they may be a flood risk once they're all built. And I'm wondering whether that is going to be something that's considered as we go along, because if you've got 1,000 houses being built but only 200 at a time, then for planning purposes, I think I'm right, you only consider the application that's in front of you and the any potential flood risk that might send. Well, it's not even a flood risk downstream, it's the flood risk to that actual plan. Whereas there are lots of developments being built where there is going to be runoff or some effect on the local watercourses, and that seems not to be considered down the line, literally.
So you mean that the mitigation that's done for one isn't necessarily...
It's not accumulated as they go along.
Can we do that, Richard?
Through your chair, I'll come back with Councillor Lenny's question. So this is why we have a local plan. You know, because I understand that the point that's been made there. You know, are we mindful that one development might be okay, but once you start aggregating developments together, the cumulative impact of that, might be much greater than some of the parts. So when we prepare our local plan and we identify all the sites in there for allocation for housing development or any development, we're obviously consulting with the Environment Agency and other statutory stakeholders like the League Local Flood Authority, and seeking their views on what the impact of those developments would be individually and taken together as, within areas of the borough, to see what those cumulative impacts would be. We do the same for transport impacts as well, where those, in the transport context, where those residual cumulative impacts are severe, then that begs the question as to whether permission should be granted at all. But nevertheless, so yeah, what we do is within the local plan process, in preparing the plan, we're consulting with people, we understand what the impacts are, and importantly, whether those impacts can be mitigated. And that might involve, sustainable urban drainage schemes, it might involve improvements to the drainage network, Severn Trent will have something to say about that, or other projects that the Environment Agency might want to bring forward, like, for example, the Woodbrook flood mitigation scheme that's coming forward under the town deal. So that's the way that we deal with this stuff.
Okay. Councillor Lenny, is that okay?
Yeah, it's sort of after the horse has bolted, isn't it, really?
Well, there you go. Right then, Justin, I'm aware I said, would you like to close it off? And then we stopped you again. So, quick, get in.
That's fine. And just to respond to Councillor Redray's question about travel, whilst it's not within our statutory powers, or gift, if you like, to control travel or influence travel from that perspective, we simply want to... advocate alternative choices if available and if appropriate. So point taken, but certainly not within our purview to do anything draconian, if you like, in that regard.
Okay, you all right with that?
Yeah.
And not putting if you can.
No, just where possible.
Where possible.
Justin's kind of said that in his response, so that's fine.
Well, thank you very much for attending. Justin, thank you very much. And any more comments? No. And this is going to be noted with, we've not got any recommendations, have we, Sally, from this?
No, do you agree with the recommendations in the report?
I think so, yes, we do. Councillor Lennon?
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Bye-bye. Thanks very much.
Bye.
Right, the next one is item 8B, and it's a review of planning enforcement plan, and it's 166 in your agenda. Councillor Jadega is the lead member for this, and she's sent her apologies.
She's not sent apologies to her, but
she can't come, right. But we have got Sarah Hallam and Richard Bennett. So, thank you very much. If you would like to set us off on this, please.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair. If I may set us off, Sarah might like to come in on the detailed questions when we get there. I was rather hoping that Justin might answer my question for me, but he's not doing that.
Yeah, that would have only been fair, wouldn't it?
If I may be so bold, Chair, I wonder if I might, just before I get into introducing the item, first introduce members of the committee to our planning intern, Simran Najjar, who's in the room with you this evening with Michael. And I think it's important that you're all aware of Simran, because we're all know that we've had trouble in recruiting planners to the planning service in recent months, and we have therefore decided to invest in growing our own planners, and part of that approach is work with Loughborough University in the School of Urban Planning to provide an opportunity for a year out student to come and work with us as a planning intern. So Simran's been with us for just over a week now. She's still with us, so we've not got her off just yet. She'll be with us until September next year, and working across the planning service, firstly in the local planning team with Michael and the team, working on HMOs and biodiversity, and goodness only knows what else, before then turning to development management in a few months' time. So a warm welcome to Simran from me, and I'm sure I'd sort of introduce you all together virtually from afar. So there you go.
Welcome, Simran. And she's already helped me celebrate my birthday today. She's got a chocolate bar that you're missing out on. So, welcome.
Right, Chair, if I may. I've got a sort of a common introduction to the two items that are on the agenda from planning tonight. So bear with me if you would. So the overview for these two items is that we had an independent review of the development management process that some of you will remember and be familiar with. And that was undertaken by an organisation called Planning Officers Society Enterprises earlier this year. There is actually a background paper on the agenda for Cabinet, which has the POS report, as we call it, for you to look at if you want to go to it. That review gave rise to 14 recommendations to improve the efficiency of planning, to change the processes, the way we do things, and to streamline officers' interactions with the democratic process, the way we work with you, basically. What we've done is we brought forward those recommendations in discussion and consultation with members and managed that in an action plan. And again, I think that's a background paper on the agenda for you to look at too. Now, many of those recommendations are operational matters for the service, but some of them actually require changes to the constitution so we can do the things that we want to do. We've held several technical briefings over the summer and held consultation on proposals to change the enforcement plan, and that was done in August. The key changes are to delegate authority to me for planning enforcement decisions, to change the call-in process for planning applications, and to amend the rules around public speaking at committee. They're the main changes. And Cabinet are being asked to consider a revised enforcement plan and changes to the constitution to enable the recommendations of POS to be taken forward. So that's the overview, Chair. So I'm now going to turn my attention to the enforcement plan report, which is the item we're looking at first. Just to say that the current enforcement plan that we use was adopted, I think it was in 2018, and it is important that we do periodically review and update our plans to ensure that we are providing an appropriate and efficient service to meet Cabinet aspirations and to reflect government policy as it changes. So the POS review is very timely, and we've therefore used that as a basis to inform and guide the review and kickstart it and get it away. It is something that was in our service plan for review this financial year, and the POS review has enabled us to bring that forward in the year to do it sooner rather than later. So, POS found that the existing rules in the Constitution that require referral of enforcement matters to ward councillors so that they can consider if they should be decided by a plans committee were inefficient and rarely exercised. And they were supposed to say they were not aware of any local planning authority in the country that had such an approach, and they recommended changing the system to delegate enforcement decisions to officers, as they have the technical and legal knowledge to make informed judgments whether to take action or not. And that's really in recognition that when you're taking formal action on planning, breaches of planning control, you are highly likely to end up defending the council's position in the courts, and you know, potentially at Crown Court. So that's big beer. So to counterbalance this change, we amended the enforcement plan or policy to set out a harm assessment and to make clear how casework will be prioritised, and that's really to sort of demonstrate to members how we will go about performing our functions under the plan. So we've also taken the opportunity to review the text more generally in the plan and to clarify it and to update it. And that revised plan is an appendix to the cabinet report. And we've shown the changes tracked, so you can see what we've changed and what we've left alone. We've also shown in appendix 2 of the cabinet report the consultation responses that we received in the summer when we consulted on the plan. So that's the report, Chair. Very happy to take any questions with Sarah's assistance.
Any questions?
I was a little bit wary of this new system, but I went to see Sarah Hallam, and she put my mind at rest, and it looks as though it could easily be something that will improve the process and not take up so much time and officers' time that could be better spent. Personally, that was my, but it was nice to be able to talk it through with an officer so that I understood exactly what was going on.
Okay.
Thank you, Sarah.
Has anybody else got any questions that they would like to ask? Richard, Sarah. Sarah, is there anything else you would like to say? Well, while Councillor Lennie's signaling her out, but what were her main concerns?
Her concerns were about the harm system that we were putting into place, and whether we were standardised with other councils, because this harm system is used by a multitude of councils all over the country, and it was a little hard to sort of explain when we had the meetings virtually, but I felt it was really helpful for Councillor Lennie to come in, and actually we went through three different cases and we harm scored it ourselves, you know, together, and I think then Councillor Lennie understood that it's quite a standardised system. The scoring is very much one for yes, zero for no, and things like that. So it's very difficult to be really varied in scoring. So if I as an officer went out and scored, we'd do a site visit and then we'd score the case to see how much harm we consider it's causing. Another officer could go out at a different time and the score would be the same. The way the scoring system works, it's very standardised.
So there's no sort of grey areas, it's a yes or no kind of thing. Yeah. So
I'm really impressed in the end.
Oh,
I'm a cynic by my birth.
Okay, so we have no questions, and we accept the recommendation. The two recommendations on the policy. Mm. Are we in agreement?
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Thank you, Sarah. Thank you, Richard.
Thank you.
Thank you. Right. although we're not letting Richard go yet, aren't we? So item C is changes to the constitution, page 212, and again it was Councillor Judega and Councillor Ashcroft, but they are not here. So we've got Richard Bennett on the planning and Adrian Ward on the audit part of the constitutional change. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Seaton. I'll just add a few words of introduction to this item, certainly in the context of what I was saying about the POS report earlier on. So obviously we just heard about the enforcement plan, and the proposed approach that's set out in that requires us to make a consequential change to the constitution to enable enforcement matters to be delegated to the head of planning and growth. There are a number of other changes recommended by POS that seek to improve the efficiency of decision making and that are set out in this item. They are changes to the call-in process for planning applications to give more time for ward councillors to call items in. Changes to the public speaking rules to make meetings more expedient and to take the pressure off ward councillors members of the plans committee. Clarification of the presentation scheme and its relationship to the pre-application work that we do with developers. Addition of procedures for late items under the extras report, just to make clear what that procedure is, because at the moment it doesn't sit within the meeting procedures. Changes relating to the procedures for section 106 agreements, and clarification about when certain applications should be referred to the plans committee, and that really is an extension from where serving officers and ward councillors might want to make a planning application. They are referred to the plans committee, but we are proposing that is extended to their partners or spouses too, in the interest of transparency. So the report before you explains the changes in part B of the report, and then provides as appendix A the relevant text from the constitution. It is an extract from the constitution, not the whole lot. And those changes are shown tracked, so you can see the proposed wording. I should also say, in addition to the changes in rules for planning matters, there are also changes in relation to the membership of the audit committee, and this is really a case of while we've got the bonnet up and we're rummaging around in the engine bay, are there any of the changes that need to be made that we could just bring together in one report to council on changes to the constitution? So I don't know whether Adrian wants to say a bit more about that or background to it, Chair.
Thank you. Can I just ask if everybody's quite happy with POS of what it stands for? Thank you very much. Adrian.
I wasn't planning to say anything else on the planning related changes, Chair, but just to explain very briefly the audit committee changes. The Chartered Institute of Public Finance and Accountancy, which is the professional accountancy body for the public sector, have recently updated their best practice guidance on audit committees that say, unless there is a statutory requirement otherwise, local authorities should consider having at least two independent members of their audit committees. We were ahead of the curve, so we've had an independent chair now for a number of years. But the audit committee have considered that updated SIPFA guidance and have agreed that to meet it, we should now change the constitution to have an extra independent person on the audit committee. So we're not proposing to pay to offer an allowance at the moment. It will just be a reimbursement of travelling expenses. And the idea would be, if it's approved by Cabinet and onward to full council, that we would then go through a recruitment process to identify a suitably experienced person to join the audit committee as an extra independent pair of eyes.
Right. Okay, more questions on the audit?
No.
Anything further to say, Richard?
No,
Chair. Well, thank you very much. Right, so we've got the recommendations on page 212. There's two recommendations there. Is the committee happy with those recommendations?
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Right, so that is 8C, and we're going on if my alphabet is fine. Oh no, I'm saying 8D, but we've not. It's item 9, which is pre-decision scrutiny, cabinet responses, page 238. Adrian.
Thank you, Chair. So this is just a regular report that comes back to the Commission to keep you up to date on Cabinet's responses to previous pre-decision scrutiny. So it's really just for noting and information, Chair.
Yep. And item 10 is scrutiny panels, page 240 on your agenda. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. So this is an update report on progress with scrutiny panels. So Commission members will be aware that supplementary report came out to you with a scoping document for the proposed public transport review. So officers and Councillor Maynard, as the proposed chair of the panel, have done some work to put this together. I think they decided that it was originally proposed as a, what do we call it, Sally?
An express
review, but they thought that having done the work on the terms of reference, it merited becoming a full formal panel review. So that scoping document is for you to consider and approve this evening, Chair. And also, if you are willing to green light it, to confirm that you're happy for it to now be a formal panel rather than an express panel. And the other update really is in relation to the proposed housing needs scrutiny panel. And I know we have Councillor Monk with us tonight, who's the chair. So Councillor Monk, I understand, has had discussions with officers about the capacity issues within the team.
Yes.
So the proposal at the moment is that because of current capacity issues, that the scoping for that panel be commenced in November with a view to coming back to yourselves in December to be approved, and for the panel then potentially to start its work in February.
Yeah, I think that was a sensible decision to make. So. I'm happy. I think the committee will be happy that it will be instead of an express, that it will be a formal panel. You've got the agenda supplement here, which is a scoping document intended to show the way forward on this thing. Still trying to think of the word, and I can't say woman of it. Yeah, we'll go with that. We'll go with that. And I think I'm thinking of something else, probably which Chinese I'm having tonight or whatever. But looking at it, it's quite expensive, and I think they're going to have to invite quite a lot of outside people in for this, the bus companies, as well as the county council, because obviously the transport is the county council. So we're happy to that to go ahead.
Yeah,
thank you. And we're happy for the housing to go back to November as well.
It makes sense if we've got a capacity issue at the moment.
Yeah. Okay. You've got a little bit longer then.
Yes, I have. More ammo. More ammo.
Right, next item is 245, and that is the scrutiny work programme. Adrian.
So, Chair, this is largely to keep you up to date on the work of the Finance and Performance Scrutiny Panel, to make sure you're aware of what they're looking at and to try and avoid duplication with your own work. I do know there is the issue about the potential scrutiny panel on council assets, and there was that we were going to wait to see what the discussion was at the recent Finance and Performance Scrutiny meeting about council assets. So there is an extract from that within your report that focuses largely on garage sites. So I don't know, Chair, whether yourself or the Commission have any views on whether that informs.
Well, when Councillor Charles put this forward, council assets, it was a very broad term, but this was coming up on the agenda of the Finance Committee, so we thought we'd have a look at what appeared. And as Adrian's pointed out, the assets are split into two parts, which is the HRA and the
General Fund.
General Fund, thank you. And so I've suggested that I go back to Mark Charles and ask him how he wants the panel to run, if indeed he does, and then we'll bring it back to the next meeting.
Yeah.
Is that okay? Thank you very much. Right, so the next item is item 12, which is the Scrutiny Commission work programme. Sorry, we'll look at the finance programme, what they've got coming, and make sure that we don't tread on their toes. And there isn't anything there that I can see that shouldn't be there. So if we move to ours now, which is the Scrutiny on 152. And we've got nothing in November. Okay, nothing on the agenda for November. But it's been pointed out that the before it goes to Cabinet, which is due, well, Judy, it says that 12th of October, but we're not there, isn't it?
No, sorry, Chair.
On the next one. I've written it on the wrong one.
Oh, the interim Charnwood transfer.
That's it, yeah. I put it on the one above. We've just done that.
On page 259, yeah. You've got what's coming forward to Cabinet.
Yeah. So the interim Charnwood transport strategy.
Yeah.
And I have that on there. That might be the only one. But Sally will send us anything that is any alterations. And please reply to her and can you CC me in if you see something on there that you want to, you would like to explore and the reasons why. But the others that are coming forward, we've got the draft capital plan, which obviously in from finance, the general fund finance, capital plan, finance, economic, well that speaks for itself. Charnwood grants, we don't...
we said on that one, because it was the strategic partners that we did want to see, the strategic partners one. Not the round two of the other one that's coming earlier, but that strategic partners one that we would see.
Could we see whether that would be ready for November? Am I...
That's a bit early, isn't it? It's not due until January.
No. Are we having a meeting in December? Yeah.
Yeah,
so we can put that on the December one.
Sorry, so the strategic partner grant funding is due to go to Cabinet on the 11th of January.
So you can have it in January.
Oh, what day is the meeting in January? First week.
It must be around the
7th. Okay. It's the second week. It's the second week. Okay, we'll have that in the January. Yep. And... can't see anything else coming up. The local development scheme, and that's we're going far ahead there, so we'll keep that one. Right, so we've done item 12 without knowing. So that's it. So the date of the next meeting is the 13th of November. Thank you very much for attending tonight.
Thank you, Chair.
Happy birthday, Chair.
Yeah.